The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable state.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has two matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 021031, Riata Construction Corp. versus City of Dallas from Dallas County, 5th Court of Appeals District, and 040181, In re Jesus M. Cortez, on behalf of the estate of Carmen Quintus, deceased. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each argument, and the court will take a brief recess after the first argument. The proceedings are being recorded, and the parties may contact the clerk's office for a copy of today's argument. There is currently one vacancy on the court, which we expect will be filled in the near future. The court is ready to hear argument in 021031, Riata Construction Corporation versus City of Dallas.
Yes, please report. Mr. Lee Cameron will present argument for the
May it please the court. The Dallas Court of Appeals decision from which we appeal suffers from several independent fatal flaws, conflicts with binding decisions of this court, and cannot be allowed to stand as a matter of established law. There are three independent reasons for that conclusion. First, as this court correctly concluded and held in its per curiam decision in this case, the City of Dallas waived immunity from suit by invoking the jurisdiction of the trial court seeking affirmative relief there. The Dallas Court of Appeals failed to follow approximately 70 years of established Texas law in binding decisions of this court by overruling the trial court on that issue. Second, the city as a home rule municipality waived immunity from suit in its charter, and the legislature waived immunity from suit in the local government code, section 51.075.
You agree, though, that you have to look at waiver on a claim-by-claim basis as opposed to in for penny, in for a pound.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I mean, don't you have to look at it on an individual claim basis? I mean, if the government were to file suit over on one discrete claim, is that just sort of Katie bar the door? Anything is then allowed against the state?
I now understand your question. Let me go back to the first point. And the answer is no, it doesn't. It has to be related to the facts and circumstances germane to the controversy.
But is it anything that might arise, any claim that could possibly be asserted based on those circumstances, or do you have to examine each individual claim?
You examine each individual claim to see if the facts and circumstances are germane to that claim and arise from the same facts and circumstances. A great example is, I believe there's out of Wichita Falls Court of Appeals, there was a case in which a hospital, state hospital, or maybe a county hospital, but in any event, a sovereign, filed a lawsuit for sworn account, and there was a counterclaim for medical malpractice. The court held that there was no waiver by filing that lawsuit, sovereign filing that lawsuit, because the counterclaim was not germane to the cause of action. The cause of action was whether the money was owed or not.
At the end of the day, where does this all get you? Because all we said in the original opinion that we issued was that it's a waiver of immunity from suit, not a waiver of immunity from liability. So how does this advance your cause at the end of the day?
First of all, you're absolutely correct. Waiver from immunity from suit is the sole issue before this court. Immunity from liability is not here. The way it advances our cause, Your Honor, is it gets us in court so that we can then prove that there's also a waiver from liability. We in this case, for example, pled a cause under the Tort Claims Act for which there is a waiver from liability. We also pled a cause that the city was acting within its proprietary function, which this court has long held.
Well, you don't need a waiver from suit for either of those claims.
I believe that's correct, and I believe that's one of the reasons why the Dallas Court of Appeals erred.
I'm just on the narrow point of a counterclaim.
On the narrow point of the counterclaim, if the city should enjoy immunity from suit, the law is crystal clear with respect to facts and circumstances germane to that action. If they invoke the jurisdiction of the court, they waive immunity from suit in that case.
But not liability.
But not liability. That is correct. That is a separate and distinct issue. And again, that's not presently before the court.
Well, but the question is, how does it help you to get immunity from suit if you're not going to get any closer to immunity from liability by doing that?
Well, Your Honor, it keeps us in court and allows us to prove the facts and circumstances would entitle us to a waiver of immunity from liability.
But you say under the Tort Claims Act, but you could make those arguments under the Tort Claims Act, and then you'd have both a waiver of suit and liability.
That is correct, and we did that.
The state argues that you're just, in its amicus, that you're just postponing the day of trial. Sure, you're there, but you're just wasting everybody's time because you can't possibly get a judgment.
I understand their argument, Your Honor, and I believe the court will understand. We have a complete difference of opinion on that issue.
Wondering what that is.
That once we're in the lawsuit, that we can prove, we pled, and we believe that we can prove the facts and circumstances that would establish immunity from liability has been waived or does not apply at all. For example,
why would a judge be more willing to listen to you under the Tort Claims Act if the plea from the other side is a plea to the jurisdiction or something than it would be once you're in the door? I don't understand why it helps you. Looks like to me you get to make all the same arguments at some point, and then you win or lose, and the only question is, do you do it sooner or later?
But the principle of law upon which gets us into court, the immunity from suit, is separate and distinct from immunity from liability. There's different principles that flow there. For example, when the city acts in its proprietary function as opposed to governmental, there is no immunity from suit. If we plead and prove a cause of action within the Tort Claims Act, there is no immunity from suit for those actions. That's how it advances our case.
If you can't win any money in this case from the city, do you get anything else of benefit, like a set-off or apportionment of the plaintiff's damages or something that justifies the city being involved?
In this particular case, Your Honor, we would, because there are other parties involved that were suing my client for monetary damages, and we would get a submission to the jury that the city was at fault. And by keeping them in the case, we'd get that submission.
Wouldn't you get that anyway?
Under the current law, Your Honor, I believe we would, but under the law applicable at the time, I believe the answer is no.
And so you think at least if you don't get any money from the city itself, you would still be entitled to some relief from the damage claims against you because the liability would be assigned to the city?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. The jury would go through and apportion the damages. If the jury apportioned any damages to the city under that scenario, it would reduce the judgment against my client, even if we couldn't recover on our claim against the city. And that's one aspect, that's one area where immunity is from suit, and being able to keep the city in the suit advances our claim, in addition to the others I mentioned, which is the city was acting proprietary function in this case for which they had no immunity. And also, we pled and intended to prove a cause of action under the Tort Claims Act.
But if they affirmatively sued you for negligence, you could, as an affirmative defense, you could say they were comparatively responsible for contributory negligence, however you want to describe it, and you would be entitled to that offset. You'd be entitled to proportionate responsibility findings, even though you can't sue them directly.
Your Honor, I believe under the state of the law as it existed prior to the recent court reform, the answer would be that you could not apportion any damages.
If they sued you?
Under that scenario, I believe that that's correct, unless there's immunity from suit.
They're a claimant, so why aren't they under, I forget which section, it's Chapter 33 it is, that a claimant's own negligence is taken into account.
I now understand the court's question. If it was just the two parties, I believe the court is right. But that doesn't apply to this case because there are actually in excess of 25 parties all seeking relief against my client. And if the city enjoys immunity from suit under the old law, we would not be allowed, this is my understanding. We certainly argue differently, but there's at least a risk we would not be allowed to have the city on the jury form with the jury apportioning liability to the city.
But you could argue the empty chair like defendants have done or did for years.
Well, Your Honor, it would not be an empty chair in this case because they invoked the jurisdiction of the court, and they're there. And they are there.
But the question is, even if they weren't there and you couldn't get a jury question, you could get a sole proximate cause instruction and say, we're not negligent because somebody else was.
Under that hypothetical, Your Honor, that would be a correct statement. However, that's very little relief in the practical world.
If this were a contract claim, not a tort claim, then there would be a waiver of liability.
That's correct.
And so what is your position on how much the government opens itself up to by way of counterclaims, cross-claims, if it sues on a contractual obligation?
Well, if it sued on the contractual obligation, it would be with the value of the contract. That's how it would open itself up.
No, I know. But then, for how much can the other side sue? Unrelated contracts, you said no.
That
would have to be the same transaction? Or?
The same facts and circumstances that give rise to the cause of action. In a contract case, more than likely, it would be the same contract. In a tort case, the facts and circumstances leading to the tort, but I understand the court's question dealt with the contract situation.
So you think Borden, the old Borden and Bates cases are still good, or at least your argument doesn't run afoul of those, because they were trying to sue on something else.
I believe that's true.
But the state argues that at the most, there should be some sort of recoupment claim like there is in the federal system. Do you agree with that or not?
Absolutely not. For one thing, under the federal system, that recoupment is pursuant to a statute, and there's no similar statute in the state of Texas. So based on that alone, there should not be recoupment. But besides that, above and beyond that fact, Your Honor, once a private litigant establishes that a sovereign has waived immunity from liability or otherwise does not enjoy immunity from liability, then they're entitled to all the rights the private litigant would have. So once we're in court, because there's been the waiver of the immunity to sue, then we have another hurdle, and that's to get over the immunity from liability. There's several ways to do that. One is Tort Claims Act, which has caps. The other is to prove that the city was acting in its proprietary capacity, which there is no way. And when it acts outside its governmental function, it's not entitled to immunity at all. The Dallas Court of Appeals ignored, in its opinion, ignored longstanding precedent from this court, going back to the Anderson-Clayton case from 1933, nearly 70 years. That case was reaffirmed by this court in Chenier in the year 2000. In that case, the Commission on Human Rights sued under a statute, and this court made it quite clear that the jurisdictional issue of immunity from suit was decided when the Commission filed that lawsuit. I would note that that was a per curiam opinion of the court. The attorney that will be arguing the case for the city was on the court at that time, and at least impliedly agreed by not dissenting. And then we go fast forward to 2002, the IT
Bailey
case.
But do you agree that the counterclaim asserted in that case was waived anyway?
In the Kinnear case?
Well, the argument's been made that really that case can be decided on that or limited to that basis. It was a claim for which there was a waiver in any event, which would support the award of attorney's fees.
But that's not how the court decided the case, though. The court expressly said, that when the commission files suit
in Nueces County.
Right.
So there's an argument made that it was more of a venue question.
I believe that would be an improper reading of the Kinnear decision, Your Honor. The Kinnear decision makes it clear that once they file the suit, the question of jurisdiction was resolved at that time. And in fact, I believe it was the IT Bailey case that, in a concurrent opinion written by Justice Heck and joined by now Chief Justice Jefferson and Justice Owen, Justice Heck wrote, it's long been held that the state can waive immunity by filing suit. That's been the law of this land since at least 1933. It's been the supreme law of the state of Texas since that time. Arguably, it was the law in the state since 1904 when the state of Clout case was decided.
I don't get the impression that anyone would argue with that proposition. It's just okay. How broad is the scope of that waiver? What is properly defensive and what's affirmative? There is a line of authority that says, you know, if it's affirmative, it's barred by immunity. But if it's properly defensive only, it's not. So there's nothing really that would preclude that analysis.
Once the sovereign invokes the jurisdiction of the court by seeking affirmative relief, then it steps in the shoes of the private litigant for all matters germane to that controversy, the facts and circumstances that arose at that time. That's been black letter law. That's the supreme law of this land, this state has been for nearly 70 years.
Let's go back to sue and be sued language, putting waiver by conduct to the side for just a second. In your second point, you said that the city waived immunity in its city charter and the legislature waived immunity by statute. Are both of those waivers necessary?
No, they're not. The waiver by the city and its charter in this charter is sufficient. The city has, as a home rule municipality, has all the rights to enact whatever legislation it needs to for its own self-governing, as long as it doesn't conflict with the Constitution or general laws of the state of Texas.
And you think that home rule authority includes the right of municipalities, even if there was no statute on the books from the legislature, to waive immunity for themselves?
Absolutely, Your Honor. There's no question.
Well, the city's immunity derives from the state, correct?
The city's immunity derives
entirely
from the state, from the Constitution and the Home Rule Act.
So as long as the legislature does not contradict a city's attempt to waive immunity, then you think the city can do it independently, even if there's no statute on the books?
That's an absolute correct statement of the law, Your Honor. Absolutely correct. And if I would, I want to address one point that you brought up at the very beginning. When you said putting aside waiver by conduct, filing a lawsuit is not waiver by conduct. Waiver by conduct, as it's been used in this court, deals with the facts and circumstances, something that's... I'm sorry, I've run out of time.
You can finish your thought.
Thank you, Your Honor. Waiver by conduct, as always with this court, dealt with the actual conduct of the facts and circumstances at issue, such as how a municipality handled a contract. It has to be something performance-based. It has never been, and this court has never indicated, that conduct in this context has anything to do with seeking affirmative relief in both of the jurisdictions of the trial court.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
Okay, this is the court.
May it please the court. I believe that the question that is before the court today is whether the court is going to recognize a waiver by litigation conduct rule in our immunity law. If the court were to do so, I believe it will dramatically change the landscape of Texas immunity law because it cannot be reconciled with the relevant statutes and it cannot be reconciled with this court's controlling precedents. And I think the reason why it can't be reconciled goes to the first question that Justice O'Neill asked. And that's because such a rule asks the wrong question and, in fact, forecloses the ability to ask the right question and the question that has always been asked under Texas law when immunity is raised. The right question, and the one that we have always asked under Texas law, is whether the courts have the subject matter of the claim being made against the government. An equitable court-created waiver rule asks a different question, whether the government appears as a claimant or a defendant. And if the answer to that question is that the government has appeared as a claimant, then immunity is waived. There are very serious consequences to changing the question. An equitable court-created waiver rule will result in a trumping of the legislature's various immunity regulation statutes. This case is a prime example of how this would work. It creates a very broad waiver, as the court has intimated in its questions. If we start by looking at Wichita Falls State Hospital, which is one of this court's most recent pronouncements and a very comprehensive view of immunity law in Texas, we know that the fundamental principle that underpins immunity law is the need to protect the public fisc and allow the legislature to manage it.
But there has to be some ability to defend yourself if the government sues you.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
How far does that go?
I believe that Justice O'Neill correctly characterized what the law is. It is as to matters defensive, germane to the claim, as opposed to matters affirmative in terms of affirmative relief in order to fulfill the underlying policy.
Well, for example, in this case, just to keep it very simple, I know it's not this simple, but the city sues alleging negligence in the cutting of the water line, and the defendant wants to counterclaim and say, no, it was your negligence in not telling us where it was. Can you bring that claim?
I think you can because it's defensive. The city's claiming damage to its water main. A defensive claim would be, no, it's not my fault, it's your fault.
So then, so it's kind of contributory negligence.
Absolutely.
And so you're going to submit that. And if it was just as between those two parties, the defensive answer might defeat the claim.
Yes.
But wouldn't result in a recovery.
Absolutely.
But could they use it now in this more complicated setting to assign part of the responsibility to the plaintiffs to the city, so the plaintiffs can't recover against the city any more than we ought to can? So it's just a question of whose responsibility is it?
I think that they cannot pass through a contribution claim because that, too, would be an affirmative claim. It's the plaintiff's affirmative claim, then. A contribution claim is derivative. So, again, we run into the same problem, which is why the matters have to be defensive in nature. And I think, Your Honor, that there's a second piece to the puzzle about what the state waives, and the state then consents to be subject to the same procedural rules as any other litigant.
It's not really a claim for contribution, is it? That's been abolished. We're now under proportionate responsibility, even under the previous statute. It was a proportionate scheme. And where's the harm to the public fisc if the city can never be liable to either the plaintiff who's suing the city or the defendant who's bringing the city in as a third-party defendant just for purposes of assignment of liability?
Because the legislature has made the policy choice that the state or the governmental entity should not even undertake the expense of defending the
suit. Why would they
suit?
Undertake the expense of defending if they have no liability? Why would they care if they got named? Let the two parties who have the dollars on the line litigate. The city's named, they're a party, they don't need to defend because there's not going to be any liability.
I guess I'm hard-pressed to imagine that we're going to allow the government to be made a party to a lawsuit and then expect them to say, we don't care what you do and we're not going to participate or pay to participate in the litigation. Immunity from suit goes to subject matter jurisdiction. That's why we look at it on a claim-by-claim basis as opposed to a question about how someone is postured and whether the state is, in fact, seeking affirmative relief. And the reason why we're looking at subject matter jurisdiction is that the legislature has made the policy choice that the government should not be in court in
cases. But once the government steps in itself and asks for affirmative relief, why shouldn't that at least remove the bar to having an assignment of responsibility, even though the city or the governmental entity will never have to pay?
Well, I think that would be a defensive matter. As a defensive matter, I agree with you, but not as a matter of seeking affirmative relief where the government would have to pay money. And it would be a defensive matter to defend against the city's claim by saying it's not our responsibility, it's yours.
So in this case, all that the original opinion said was it's a waiver of, once the city comes in and makes an affirmative claim, we didn't say it's a waiver of liability. All we said in that original opinion was it's a waiver of immunity from suit, so that if it went back, the city's responsibility, if any, could be apportioned by the trier fact. But the city wouldn't have any liability for contribution, assuming that it's not covered by the tort claims.
But I don't think that the state's conduct can vest the court with jurisdiction over a claim. Immunity
you said
from suit,
you can on a defensive claim, but not when you have a third-party mix. I don't see the symmetry.
And the reason is this. The court's language in the per curiam opinion is language of personal jurisdiction, not language of subject matter jurisdiction. The language in the opinion says that the state, by its action, waived immunity and submitted to the jurisdiction of the court. For personal jurisdiction principles, that rule applies. But a party can never, by its action, voluntarily coming into court or taking some sort of litigation action, vest a court with subject matter jurisdiction.
Was Kinnear wrong?
So Kinnear was correctly decided, and I believe, Chief Justice Jefferson, that it is a leaper case. And if you look at the language in the opinion, it meets that category that you put in your Wichita Falls opinion about leaper. That was an enforcement action by the state under the Fair Housing Act, and the language of the opinion was that once the governmental agency did the affirmative step of bringing the enforcement action, then as a consequence, because the legislature had given had indicated that the prevailing party would recover attorney's fees, the state was subject to that. I believe that in Wichita Falls, that was characterized as a waiver by the state. That's the language of Kinnear. It's a leaper case. It's not anything more than that.
You said that an entity can never invest subject matter jurisdiction by its conduct. Very broad statement. So nothing the state could do by conduct, by filing a document, could waive immunity.
That's correct.
The state could show up with the counsel and trial of the governor and the lieutenant governor, stand up and say, Judge, we're here. We waive immunity on behalf of the state. We want to proceed. We know there's no statute on the books, but that still doesn't waive immunity, in your opinion.
I think that's correct. I think if you look at all the law and subject matter jurisdiction, either in the immunity context or any other context, a party need not even raise subject matter jurisdiction. A matter can be pending before an appellate court, and the words subject matter jurisdiction have never left the mouths of any lawyer involved in the case, and a court can sua sponte. An appellate court can decide that there was no subject matter jurisdiction. The actions of the party cannot give the court jurisdiction. That's why this waiver rule doesn't fit. And when you use personal jurisdiction concepts and overlay them over the subject matter issue that's before the court, then you destroy our immunity law. And the reason why you do that is because, again, as I said, you're asking the wrong question. You're focusing on the litigant's conduct rather than on the client. And the legislature, and this court has recognized that it's the legislature's responsibility to set up the immunity schemes by statute to consent to whether the state can be sued. We have the Tort Claims Act.
Let's talk about that for a minute, because the sue and be sued language, or plead and implead, would we have to overrule MOPAC to go your way on that?
I think that MOPAC has effectively been overruled by this court's later decisions and by the legislature's actions. I think that MOPAC should be formally overruled because I do not think that it accurately represents Texas law, and I think it is void of any kind of analysis, and I think that the impact that it would have, that it has, it's a very broad waiver. Most municipalities have
So we would have to overrule it.
I think you should because it's causing confusion.
Well,
yes.
And is your only argument that the legislature has gotten away from it, its mandate that the waiver be clear and unambiguous?
No. I think that it also, it's very broad language, sue and be sued. It would be a broad waiver that you could sue the city of Dallas for anything, anywhere, at any time. The same thing would apply to most municipalities in the state. There is sue and be sued language in the education code for school districts. Most universities,
but
and
it only waives, again, only waives immunity from suit, not immunity from liability.
I understand, but there's...
And the very next session after the MOPAC case was decided, the legislature picked up that language and put it in three or four different statutes and has done it almost every session since.
But there are other statutes, and some of the statutes involving universities, for example, that have sue and be sued language, and then have second...
There are only
provision,
two, to my knowledge, out of hundreds.
Well, and have a second provision in them that indicates that the language should be construed as a waiver and or it should not be construed as a waiver.
But there are only two of those out of all the dozens and dozens.
I agree, but the point is this in terms of the sue and be sued language that does exist in many several enabling statutes as the state has cited, is that that's a very broad waiver. How do we reconcile that with the very specific immunity statutes that are on the books? For example, in this case, they say sue and be sued very broad. That the city waived immunity under that particular language. If that's the case, does that mean the Tort Claims Act doesn't apply? Because the city chose to do that, and the city of Dallas has opened itself up.
We've long held that the more specific statutes trump the general statute. So this is not a wholesale. Aren't we just really looking at sue and be sued language on contract claims?
Well, this is a tort claim.
I know that. That's why the tort. Wouldn't the Tort Claims Act govern trump the more generic sue and be sued language because the Tort Claims Act is more specific?
Well, then the question becomes, for example, the Dallas City Charter. There's language in the Dallas City Charter about a claims process that is to be followed in terms of making claims against the city of Dallas. Does that sue and be sued language then trump the specific provisions in the Dallas City Charter regarding claims? The problem is that if you do sue and be sued, historically, it's capacity language. It's called
That's not what we said in MOPAC. Now, let's say I'm a contractor and I want to contract with the city of Dallas. And I look at MOPAC and I say, sue and be sued. If I run into trouble, I can sue them. What about reliance on this precedent for people who are out there contracting with the city?
Well, they need to read more of the Dallas City Charter then, because there is other language that would have given them notice that, in fact, that wasn't the case.
Is this city charter provision, is it in the power section of the city charter, or is it like a special section regarding litigation matters?
The sue and be sued piece is in the power section.
Which would
of the
indicate
city charter.
Capacity.
Exactly. It indicates, it has the whole list of things that gives the state capacity
so
as a
MOPAC
body corporate and politic.
MOPAC obviously wasn't a city case, and so I think each context is somewhat different. You know, you're talking about universities, you're talking about the MOPAC case, and then this charter. So where the location this is in the charter seems to be important.
I think it is important, and I think the problem with MOPAC and why I say that I think it's not good law and it's been effectively overruled is there's no analysis in MOPAC whatsoever. None. And if you look at the analysis in Wichita Falls that brings together all of the developments of immunity law since then and the several requirements that were laid out, if you apply those requirements to the sue and be sued language, it cannot pass muster. So that's when I say
why did the legislature, when they came back and tried to amend one of our decisions, use sue and be sued to clearly indicate that there would be a waiver from immunity from suit?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
The legislative history, I forgot the name of the decision that we issued, but the legislature came back in fairly short order and rectified one of our decisions on sovereign immunity. And they used the word sue and be sued to make it crystal clear that that meant that it was a waiver from immunity.
Are you talking about Pelzel?
Yes.
But they also had other language. It wasn't just sue and be sued language in that statutory enactment. It also had the express language of waiver.
But there's no
immunity.
Denying that sue and be sued was used in that context.
But it was used in the context of other language to comport with the requirement of the Code Construction Act. That's my whole point. Sue and be sued standing alone doesn't get you there.
Sue and be sued, plead and then plead, similar language.
Right, but standing alone, it doesn't get there, because if you apply the Wichita Falls test, that the statute must waive immunity without a doubt, that ambiguities are resolved by retaining immunity, and there is a separate consideration, and then finally, whether the statute also provides an objective limitation on the state's potential liability, which sue and be sued does not do. It does not take into account the public fisc. So I think that the Pelzel statute came back and was very specific and meets those requirements. Sue and be sued does not meet those requirements.
What's the city's position regarding its ability under the Home Rule Amendment in the Constitution to waive immunity? If they put it in their charter where it was crystal clear they were waiving immunity, or they passed a ordinance waiving immunity with regard to a certain suit, would that be effective, or
yes.
Does it require legislative action?
No, I think the city has all the powers of self-government, provided it does not run afoul of legislative or constitutional enactments. And if I could just go back to Justice O'Neill's question with respect to the charter, in addition to the claims provision, there is another provision of the Dallas City Charter in terms of notice to people, which says this: nothing contained herein shall be construed as creating a cause of action, nor get the giving of any right to institute or maintain any suit or action which would not otherwise exist or be cognizable under the laws of legal claim. So I don't think that there's a notice problem in terms of what people have said, and I think that MOPAC is inconsistent with Wichita Falls.
So do you think MOPAC then, because the sue and be sued language appears in the powers clause of the city's charter, do you think that we can then distinguish MOPAC as opposed to overrule it? Can we limit it?
I think you could distinguish it, Your Honor. I think the issue that I would imagine the state of Texas would address with you is that sue and be sued language like it exists in so many different places for the same purpose, for capacity purposes in terms of an agency's enabling statute, that I don't know that you would resolve all the confusion in the law by distinguishing the Dallas City Charter.
Counselor,
I think you could do that.
15 minutes.
I have one other question. Clearly, we've said that the legislature, and now the legislature has said it by statute 2001, to waive immunity, it must be by clear and unambiguous language. Where have we said that that waiver must be by statute? What cases have we said that?
Well, most recently, one of the most recent cases is Wichita Falls.
Wichita Falls doesn't really say that. It says if a statute does have a resolution that waives immunity, it must be by clear and unambiguous language. Doesn't say it has to be by statute. Where have we said it has to be by
statute?
Well,
it says by legislative enactment or constitutional provision is what I read. It was, but I don't have the case right in front of me, but my notes indicate that's the quote that I have from that.
What page is your quote on?
I'll be happy to get my notebook and look at it if you'd like me to, Your Honor. I'm looking at a Westlaw copy, which is, let's see, the actual Southwestern Reporter site page, I believe, is 695. And it says, consequently, to waive immunity, consent to suit must ordinarily be found in a constitutional provision or legislative enactment. It's under Head Note 4, the first paragraph under Waiver of Immunity.
And, Counsel, you've divided your time with the state.
May it please the Court. Much of the discussion this morning has concerned the scope of arguments that can be asserted against the state when the state brings suit. It is our position that a party sued by the state can raise defenses but cannot receive an affirmative monetary award.
In this case, contributory negligence is actually, is that a defense or is that a claim?
To the extent that it's challenging the city's right to recover for the property damage to city property, it will be acting as a defense.
But you're going to, it's going to be an active claim. You're going to say, was somebody negligent? Was the city negligent? So it's going to be submitted to the jury as an active claim.
I think that's absolutely.
But you think it's defensive?
It is, because it challenges, it is a matter properly defensive, because it challenges the foundation of, in this case, the city's right to recover on its claim. It's not seeking an independent monetary award.
In a contract case, would a set-off be defensive if the set-off related to the subject matter of the case?
The general answer is no.
Why is that? You can say the city sues its contractor and says, you didn't build this right, and the contractor says, well, you didn't pay me for what I did build right. And that would not be an acceptable defensive plea in your view.
No, it would not. The reason is that it doesn't, unless that counterclaim for breach of contract goes to the foundation of the state's claim, unless that breach by the state would have defeated its own right to recover as a prior material breach or as breaching a condition precedent, then it's not actually a defensive claim. In modern commercial contracts, even in a single contract, there can be many duties that are independent of each other. Those should be treated like independent claims, and for a breach of that, the court should look to see whether there's been an independent waiver of sovereign immunity from suit. The situation, I see that my time has expired, Mr. Chief Justice.
You'll finish your thought.
But it's easy to imagine a situation in a modern construction contract case, for example, where there's a whole web of contracts, subcontracts, and tort duties. It can't be that the state, by bringing suit to assert a single duty against a single one of those contractors, opens up the whole realm of contract and tort claims, including many contract claims. And for example, if it were to briefly answer Justice Owen's question about what's the harm if we're ultimately immune from liability, one of the harms is that we're not immune from liability for breach of contract. So some courts of appeals have allowed both, for when the city brings a tort case, have allowed, for example, both contract and tort claims to be asserted in response.
Any further questions?
Yes, I'm still interested in this issue, and I know I've taken up your time past the allotted amount. If the waiver is by constitutional provision, if that's the assertion, without a statute, for instance, petitioner's assertion that the city could waive immunity because it is a home rule city, and assume there's no statute, would you agree that the city could then waive its immunity?
If there were a constitutional provision to that effect, the answer would be yes. I think in the case of the Home Rule Act, the Constitution enables the legislature to pass statutes authorizing it. And in this case, the legislature has.
And if the legislature had not in this case, but the city in its charter was believed it waived immunity without a statute, would you agree that the city had waived immunity?
No, I think if the... I'm not sure I understand your question. You're asking
if... Let me rephrase it. If... through the home rule provision, Dallas has, as we know, the provision that says it may sue and be sued. Without a statute, would you agree that, well, I guess you'd take the opposite position from the petitioner. Do you think there has to be a city charter provision as well as a statute in order for there to be a waiver of immunity? And that they both have to be clear and unambiguous?
The answer to that question is yes. We don't believe that 51075 is a clear and unambiguous waiver by itself. If you move to the petitioner's argument, which is that the city nonetheless might have had power under its, as a home rule act city, to waive immunity, we think that kind of waiver should also be evaluated under the clear and ambiguous test this court has used for 25 years, including the Taylor Factors.
I have an informational question that I don't want to get lost. What happened to the Northern District suit?
It was tried to a conclusion, Your Honor. We were not happy with the conclusion. We filed a motion for a new trial. We intend to appeal. And also, the city raised immunity from suit before Judge Buttmeyer down there, and Judge Buttmeyer overruled it. And they also raised immunity from liability, and Judge Buttmeyer overruled that. Now, the jury overruled us, but we're not done yet. In this case, what the city is asking this court to do is overrule three separate lines of cases. The Anderson-Clayton case, which has been on the books for 70 years, the MOPAC decision, which has been on the books for 34 years, and the string of cases that have been on the books for a number of years, that in doing the jurisdictional analysis on the waiver or the immunity from suit, you were to construe the pleadings liberally in favor of jurisdiction. So in order for the city to prevail here, this court would have to overrule three separate and distinct lines of cases. Interestingly, going to the MOPAC decision that Ms. Hankinson just asked this court to overrule, when she was on the bench sitting in one of those chairs, she wrote the Petzl decision. It was an 8-1 decision by this court, drafted by Ms. Hankinson. And this is what the court said in 2002, just 2 years ago, about Missouri Pacific. That arguably showing intent, quote, intent to waive sovereign immunity, the sue and be sued language shows, quote, intent to waive sovereign immunity pursuits. That's just 2 years ago, a pronouncement of this court written by then Justice Hankinson. The decision goes on and favorably cites MOPAC for holding that sue and be sued stands for the proposition of there's an immunity or there's a waiver of immunity from suit. And then finally, on page 251 of that decision, the sue and be sued phrase was interpreted by this court to mean this, quote, is quite plain and gives general consent for district to be sued in the courts of Texas. It's the same language we're dealing with here, Your Honor. And in addition, in the city's charter, the city's entitled to implead and be impleaded in all courts in the state of Texas. The Anderson-Clayton decision specifically says that a litigant is entitled to bring a cross-complaint. The words of this court, cross-complaint. A few years later, in 1939, in the Worthen decision, this court cited with favor the State v. Clout decision, which stated and stood for the proposition that once a sovereign invokes the jurisdiction of a court seeking affirmative relief, that they step in the shoes of private litigants for all purposes, which would include a cross-claim. With respect to the argument by the city that the court's ruling consistent with its per curiam decision would open the doors, the floodgates, if you will, the Anderson-Clayton decision has been on the books now for 7 years.
I don't see how it's so inconsistent with Anderson-Clayton, their position, because the language says that, well, in IT Davy we said the only exception to the legislature's sole province to waive immunity is when the state initiates suit. But our statement in Anderson-Clayton said, except insofar as the rules may be modified in favor of the state by statute, or may be inapplicable or unenforceable because of exemptions inherent in sovereignty. So how is that inconsistent? Because it does seem to leave the door open to the properly defensive argument.
When you read the Anderson-Clayton case carefully, there really is no ambiguity. This court sets forth the question that is considering the issue of immunity from suit. It then does the analysis of immunity from suit. So the language the court just referred to cannot refer to immunity from suit. It may, for example, say, step in the shoes for private litigants for all purposes in this case, but you may have certain other immunities, like immunity from liability, that have to be dealt with later. That's how it's consistent.
When you use the step in the shoes of the plaintiff language, you're not relying on any case for that sort of. And I've never read anything that says you step in the shoes of a private plaintiff.
The State v. Clout, I'm paraphrasing, but the State v. Clout case says worse to the fact that the sovereign in that situation closed itself in the robes, I believe, was the language, or close to it, of a private litigant. And that case was cited with approval by this court in 1939 in the Worthen decision. I see I'm out of time for any more questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Counselor. The cause is submitted, and the court will now take a brief recess. Thank you.